So, good morning. So we have a discussion session on the quantum Hall effect in graphene today. The recommendations for this session that I have received is that we have two Blackboard contributions which should lead up to the discussion, and one should point out the problems that are more or less open and also interesting, rather than talk about completed works. So we'll try to keep a nice balance in this regard. So two contributions would be mine and Mark. So I guess I will start, and Mark will take over. Okay, so I will start with a sort of graph of aspects of the quantum Hall effect in graphene, which are important, interesting, or both. And then I will stick to one part of this graph, which are the problems which are dear to me and which I was working on. So we have. Hall effects in graphene. Interactions. Are extremely important in the systems because we have quenched kinetic energy, so the interaction energy becomes essentially dominant, and this can be seen by comparing just the energy scales. So if I take the spectrum for monolayer, the typical Landau level spacing energy for lower levels is around 300 Kelvin at 1 Tesla and scales as a square root of the perpendicular magnetic field. If I take bilayer, the Landau level spacing is linear in magnetic field and is more or less 30 Kelvin per Tesla. Now I take the typical Coulomb energy. This is around 650 Kelvin per 1 Tesla and scales quadratically as a function of the perpendicular magnetic field. So for monolayer, we see that Coulomb energy is comparable and even somewhat greater than the Landau level spacing. For bilayer, at typical experimental, yes?
There may be some screening in that.
Sure. So for bilayer, at typical experimental magnetic fields on 1 to 10 Tesla, Coulomb energy is much greater than the Landau level spacing. So this means that in reality, even if you don't have, so in principle you could have screening by the electric environment, but even if you don't have that, for example, you have suspended sample, then in reality you would also have screening coming from just from the electron system. And in the end, your typical interaction energy would be something on order of the Landau level spacing itself. Theoretically, the only way to do it in a controlled, more or less controlled way is say that you treat your number of flavors, which is 4 in reality, as a large parameter, then that in principle for actually large M, this justifies this random RPA screening. Okay, so interactions are important. What else could we have? We could have disorder. We could have strain-induced pseudo-magnetic fields. So I will not pursue these directions. We have experts on both of these topics. Maybe Sasha Mirian could comment something on disorder in quantum Hall effects, or Paco on the strain-induced magnetic fields. Instead, I will stick to this part. So then, depending on the Landau level index and the filling factor, one could have a variety of interaction-induced states. An integer filling factors. One could form incompressible states which have spatially homogeneous electron density. This is described by the theory of quantum Hall ferromagnetism. Where ferromagnetism should really be taken in quotes, because that refers to ordering of whatever discrete degrees of freedom present in the system. So in the case of graphene, that includes not only spins, but also values. One can have fractional quantum Hall effect, and Mark will take over this part. And so, in principle, so one has in the interaction-induced states which have spatially homogeneous density, but there are competitors to these phases with spatially non-uniform density, the states like striped and bubble phases. And it is known that they can compete with these phases at both integer and filling fractions. So the part I'd like to focus on is this quantum Hall ferromagnetism. And the first problem there is the problem of ground state order. So we have to the leading approximation, we have a high degeneracy in the valence spin space, and the question is what would be the preferable order in the space in real system, and theoretically can we sort of list all the possible phases which we could have realistically in the system. And then after this problem has been sorted out, there are a number of problems which are related to the charge excitations in the system. Experimentally, for graphene, it's quite hard to probe the actual spin or charge density weight textures. So at this point, pretty much the main tool of experimenters is transport, so we need to relate the preferred order to some experimental data. We need to figure out what the charge excitations are. And this is, for the most part, Skirmion physics. And there are still a number of directions. Bulk excitations are of interest for the new equal zero state in both monolayer and bilayer. Edge excitations can be described within the framework of quantum Hall ferromagnetism, while for other Phelan factors there is no kind of real issue about edge excitations. They for non-zero nu, they're universal. And then there is a another problem of transport along the domain walls of different orders, which in principle can occur in real system close to the phase transition. And it seems like this is indeed the case in the experiments in bilayer, where the phase transitions are characterized by some spikes in conductance. Okay, so for now I would like to talk about this part. Let's say I have a single Landau level in graphene, doesn't matter. Let's take monolayer graphene for simplicity, and doesn't matter actually which Landau level. So my single particle spectrum looks like this. I have some orbital index. I can take a symmetric gauge, and this would be the one-dimensional momentum. I can discretize it for theoretical purposes by considering a sample of finite size. And I have fourfold degeneracy of each Landau level. So here I will show them a split just for illustration purposes. No splitting is implied in reality. I can choose the some basis in the valley and spin space, and to the leading approximation. My Hamiltonian consists just of the interaction part. Which is symmetric in the valley and spin space. So here, psi are the fermion operators for a given Landau level, and they are spinners in the valley times spin space. So it's four component spin. And I have a unit matrix at the vertex of the interaction. So then if I take some integer Phelan factor, in principle there are essentially only two qualitatively different possibilities for fourfold degenerate spectrum. I can have half filled on the level with two electrons per orbital, or I can have quarter filled and then three quarters filled, but they are related by the particle Hall symmetry. So let me consider an interesting case of half field Landau level. This would be, for example, nu equals zero state for monolayer. Then what I can do, I can put my electrons in the same orbital, in the same state, in the four-dimensional valley time spin state for each orbital. And what I also want to do, I'll choose an arbitrary basis in the valley time spin. So I will not even specify the spinners. And in this space. So I can construct such mini body wave function. It's just a slattery determinant. And if I act on it with the Hamiltonian of symmetric interactions, I see immediately that I recover the state, which means it's an eigenstate. And so the motivation for choosing the state is very simple, it's just the Hund's rule. So I have repulsive interactions, I want to minimize the energy of repulsion, so the idea is to put, for a given density, electrons as far apart from each other as possible. This means I want to make the orbital part of the wave function maximally anti-symmetric, which means I have to take the spin part, which also include in this generalized space of valiant actual spin, maximally symmetric, so I put the electrons in the same two-particle state for each orbital. So the idea is just the Hund's rule. Immediately we show that this is an eigenstate. There is no proof that this is a ground state for generic interactions. And there are counterexamples where this is not the case, and competing orders are usually some states which have spatially inhomogeneous charge distribution. But that usually happens at higher Landau levels and higher filling factors when your form factors start oscillating, and the effect of interactions are not that repulsive anymore. So that's the reason. But in key, so if those phases do not get in the way, so we know that eigenstate becomes a ground state of the system.
But for some eigen to take into account the Zeeman splitting?
Yes, at the later stage. Yes, absolutely. But to the leading order, as I showed, the energy scale, so this is almost Landau level spacing over the number of flavors. So that's already pretty good progress. We know essentially the ground state for symmetric interactions, but the problem is that this ground state is degenerate. So the degeneracy can be uniquely parameterized by this density matrix of the two electrons in the valley time spin space, and this can be treated as the order parameter. So this is true for any matrix P of this type, where you choose just two arbitrary orthogonal spinners in the valley time spin space. So we know the ground state, but it is highly degenerate, and we understand that in reality this cannot hold. In reality, we'll have some perturbations which will explicitly break this SU4 symmetry in the valley time spin space and favor some preferred order. And essentially, what we need to do is figure out what are the realistic perturbations which explicitly break the value of spin symmetry, which need to be taken into account. So there are obvious single particle mechanisms. Zeeman term favors spin polarization. That will be the spin operator. In principle, one could add some sort of Zeeman effect for the valley isospin. For T alpha isospin operators, Pauli matrix in the valley and unit matrix in the spin. But if we think about the real system, if we take monolayer, it's quite hard to come up with the perturbation that would be realized in a real system. For example, if I take zero energy Landau level, the value is equivalent to sublattice. So if you want to polarize, let's say, along the z direction in the isospin space, this means you are applying staggered potential between the between sublattices. So that would be quite hard to implement and control. But such isospin Zeeman effect can come in the form of disorder. Essentially, any short range disorder, they would.
Just perhaps you should mention. I mean, there are some mechanisms that give rise to this sublattice symmetry breaking. For example, if you consider an out of plane monofono, in this case, you can have some sort of deformation of the sublattice.
We're coming to this, but this is a many body effect.
Yeah,
If you freeze that mode, sure.
I think in terms of a freeze frozen mode, so really in sort of some in the form of some static.
Okay. Yes. If it's term, static, sure.
It exists. For example, the Kikuli type distortion is of that type, so it is supposed to be static.
So it's.
This is an in-plane. The Kikuli type distortion is an in-plane form. So frozen in plane phonon, whereas here
how do you,
breathing.
How do you freeze it?
It is some sort of pious type instability. It's triggered by magnetic.
So, what you will have most definitely are dynamic phonons, which you don't freeze, but this is a many body effects, which I want to discuss now. Okay, but one more comment. In bilayer, though, for the zero energy Landau level, the wave functions for each value reside in different layers. And the experimenters managed to implement this type of Bailey Zeeman field by creating dual gated devices so that they can control both the carrier concentration and the layer charge imbalance independently. And the latter serves as a this polarizer as a in the Zeeman, sorry, in the Valley space. Okay. So but now there are many body effects of Valley symmetry breaking. I can have two particle interactions which are explicitly asymmetric in the Valley space. And important to realize it is that they're always there. So this continuous symmetry in the Valley space is only an approximate symmetry of your low energy approximation. The real symmetry is this discrete symmetry of the crystal lattice, and in principle, just purely from group theoretical point of view, one can run down terms which are not prohibited by the symmetry of the crystal lattice, and that will give you in the Dirac model various asymmetric channels in the sublattice and Valley space. Physically, that comes from the fact that your interactions, so we have, for example, sublattice index. If I take interactions between electrons residing on the same sublattice and on different sublattices, there is some slight spatial mismatch. And that difference gives me some asymmetric interactions in the low energy model. This is one example. So that would give me, for example, tau z channel. Another example is if I take optical phonon modes, and they usually have pretty high energies, 0.2 electron volts, I guess that's what, that range. I can integrate them out for the interest of lower energies, and they give me effective two-particle interactions for electrons. and those phonons, they will give me, they will be asymmetric in the valley channel. Another thing, if for example, if you want some, so there are two coupling constants which characterize the interactions for a given Landau level. So one is the this perpendicular channels which involve valley spin, valley flip, and there is the Stau-Zet channel, which is asymmetric, but it doesn't involve the valley flip. So in principle, these interactions, they can come from breather modes in monolayer graphene from electron-phonon interactions. But for electron-electron interactions, at the bare level, they need to involve some overlap of the orbitals residing on AMB sublattice. So you could argue that should be quite small, but there is another aspect. If you start with some bare couplings, all these couplings are short-range because they come from atomic scales. So they are irrelevant in the RG sense. But we have Coulomb interactions, which are marginal, and they will give strong renormalizations of these couplings. And even if you start with a few channels, so for example, if you keep only this, you will see that this channel will also be generated in the RG flow. So there are quite a few reasons why generically you should have both of these couplings in the interactions in the real system. So, and that is kind of the main problem that I was dealing with recently. So these terms break explicitly the valley symmetry, and depending on the relations between these couplings, so in principle, different phases could be favored. And
you write a diagram to illustrate how these couplings have been normalized by the long range interaction.
You mean the RG?
Yeah. Well, some diagram, just to recognize
it. I can.
For instance,
in JEX,
induces
intervalley.
So how does the long range part of the interaction come?
I can. You mean the Feynman diagram?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I thought phase diagram. Uh-huh. Okay. So very simply. So this, if this is some short range channel, this is Coulomb line. That gives a log. But then you need to take into account all first loop diagrams. We have some wave function renormalization.
I'm sorry, are you talking about my purple swirling?
Yes.
Okay.
So this was worked out in detail in the paper by Igor and co-workers. Okay, so now I want to take this term into account alone. And then Zeeman at the later stage. And I will do it perturbatively. So the symmetric interactions, they have the energy roughly of the order of the Landau level spacing. These couplings, since we know that down there at the lattice scales, Coulomb interactions is all we have, there's one parametric estimate in which we can write for them. That's charge squared times some spatial lattice scale. In the quantum Hall regime, that gives us the energies which have an extra, compared to the Coulomb energy scale, which have an extra small parameter, some lattice scale over the magnetic length. And depending on what you plug in for this spatial scale, you get something another 1 to 10 Kelvin per Tesla. So these energies scale linearly with the perpendicular magnetic field. In principle, they are smaller than the leading energy, but you need to take them into account, because if you drop them, your ground state order is undetermined. So really what you need to compare them to are other symmetry breaking perturbations, such as Zeeman, and that's in the similar range. And in fact, this is the estimate for the bare values once you take into account the renormalizations due to Eger. So you can see that the magnitude of them is quite strongly enhanced. A typical magnetic fields on order like 10 Tesla, you can get enhancement of about factor of 10. You're following the time? So since these energy scales, they're smaller than the leading symmetric part of the interactions, I may in principle take them into account perturbatively, which means I just want to calculate the expectation value of these interactions with respect to this quantum Hall ferromagnet state, and that gives me, so it's a function of the order parameter for one orbital. So this is just the number of orbital states in the system. You get the expression like this. This is just the Hartree term. Yes, minus the Fock. And this function is characterized by two parameters, energy scale, U perpendicular and UZ, which in principle, without a priori assumptions about the details of the interactions, they could have different values, different signs, and could have arbitrary relative values. So the way to go is to construct the phase diagram, explore all possibilities and construct the phase diagram. Four phases, spin polarized phase. Which has to be then a very singlet to satisfy the Pauli principle.
And so is this
Zeeman splitting
equal to zero?
Yes. For Zeeman, actually for Zeeman splitting equal to zero, you can have arbitrary spin polarization. SU2 Riemannian SU2 spin symmetry. There is antiferromagnetic phase with opposite spin polarizations of sublattices. Also some Riemannian spin rotational symmetry for the overall orientation. There is charge density wave state. Where both electrons per orbital sit on just one in just one valley, and therefore for a new call zero state, for example, in one on one sublattice. And that has to be, so this is fully isospin polarized phase with isospin at the poles of the Bloch sphere. And here, and that has to be a valley spin singlet. Okay. And there is this Kekulé phase, which is also fully isospin polarized phase, but the isospin is sitting on the equator of the Bloch sphere, which means there is no net charge imbalance between the valleys, but rather there is some bond coherence. So this is the Bloch sphere for the isospin. Illustrate this phase's bond order. Okay, so this is this is the phase diagram. So the main conclusion is that even if we just take this valley asymmetric terms in the interactions into account, this huge degeneracy of the quantum Hofer magnet is mostly lifted, but the real problem is that we don't really know in which way. We don't know where real graphene is on this phase diagram. So this represents a model for graphene without any assumptions about the properties of the short-range couplings. So graphene is essentially one point. Real graphene is essentially one point on the phase diagram. And so experimentally, the situation is that in transport, this incompressible state is clearly seen. But the challenge is to figure out how the symmetry is broken. Okay, so, and finally, one can, if one adds the Zeeman effect, so this Cantid antiferromagnetic phase is, antiferromagnetic phase is transformed into the Cantid antiferromagnetic phase with some optimal spin polarization on the direction of the magnetic field. And I guess I'll stop here and let Mark take over.
Could you conclude your talk with something? What's the conclusion of what you're talking about?
So I essentially obtained the phase diagram, which lists the possibilities of how the this SU4 symmetry can be broken in the new equals zero state, for example. So the kind of next direction would be to, if you want to really understand what happens in the real system, to identify which phase is realized in real monolayer graphene in the new equals zero state. The next direction would be considering charge excitations of this system, of these phases, and trying to figure out how they depend on the parameters you could vary in the experiment. The another problem here is that these parameters, not only they're not known, they can hardly be varied in the experiment, the relative value which determines the favored phase. So essentially for monolayer, virtually the only knob one can vary is the energy of the Zeeman field relative to the anisotropies. But since those depend on the perpendicular magnetic field only. So the only way to do it is to tilt the magnetic field. So hopefully, by figuring out how the charge excitations in the system depend on this, on the Zeeman energy, one can make some predictions for the experiment and by comparing, identify the phase that is actually realized in the system. Yes?
Is there a simple way to understand the physics of the phase diagram, why, depending on this relative value of U prep and U theta, why do you get ferromagnetic states if they are both positive and very...
Yes. So, for example, if I look at this region, both of these couplings are positive, and I can apply again this Hund's rule idea to the to this part of the interactions. I have the fact that they are positive means that these interactions are repulsive in both channels. So I say that also for the valley part, I want to construct to apply this Hund's rule idea and to construct a singlet in the valley spin, in the valley space. But then it has to be the actual spin ferromagnet. This is, for example, as far as this ferromagnetic phase is concerned. So now here, if I take interactions which are attractive in both channels, isospin channels, that favors me some isospin polarization, and depending on the ratio, so I want to polarize the isospin either along the z direction or to put it in plane on the equator of the block sphere. So for this part, if I consider the subset of the order parameter where one electron sits on one sublattice, the other on the other, and has completely arbitrary spin polarization, and calculate that energy, I will find that this U perpendicular term acts as an effective exchange coupling for these spins. I guess I need a minus here. Things right. Yes. So, okay, for this part, I don't have a more kind of physical explanation, but if one considers the subset, one sees explicitly that this is some sort of, this your perpendicular anisotropy gives some sort of spin exchange for this. For this.
I had maybe one more question. I mean, you mentioned that we don't know whether real graphene sits on this diagram.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, if you just take a model, right? I mean, just put whatever, take electron-photon interactions, you know basically everything about the Hamiltonian,
mm-hmm.
and then it looks like you can take the Hamiltonian and transform these G's into U's. Has it been?
Well, this part is it's trivial.
Yeah.
So the problem is to figure out these G's. So in principle,
electrons and photons interact.
We know electron-photon interactions pretty well. So in principle, they are the sum of two contributions. So from electron-electron and electron-photon interactions. It is true that we know this part pretty well. With this part, we have, I'd say, much less certainty. Because if you do this RG, you will see that couplings may change in various, the change sign in various channels as you do the RG flow.
There are two divergent channels.
Yeah.
So basically what you need for macroscopics is two numbers on the high energy.
And you say they're both infinite.
What?
You say they're both infinite. Or just one, two numbers to come.
No, what I'm saying is basically the following. Apparently they're dimensionally relevant. Now, if you are doing diagrams which he showed that for n equals to 4, there are two linear combinations which becomes in the, which becomes practically marginal. The index is 1 minus 40 over pi squared over n, which is essentially 0 for practical purposes. Now, there are two constants which you, then, which you are supposed to extract from the macroscopic calculations on the scale of the order of the order of the lattice constant. What he is saying is that in order to extract those constants, you need to know very well the chemical structure of the orbitals. So that's it. As far as electron form interaction is concerned, the vortices are also addressed by the electron-electron interaction. There are certain renormalization which was done by Davis Boyska, I believe. But there is not a dramatic change by factor of seriousness.
I'm rather saying that it would be perhaps not reliable to claim that to commit to one of the phases, because there is still, we don't really know. We don't know accurately what these couplings are, but one can still make some reasonable assumptions. So if the electron phonon interactions, even if you do take into account renormalizations, what you can find is that they remain attractive. So the contribution from electron-phonon interaction, the bare one, is somewhere in this quadrant, and it stays there. And in reality, so these breather modes, which give you negative U perpendicular, they're known to be much stronger than any out-of-plane phonons. So out-of-plane phonons, you get some smaller contributions. So from the contribution from electron-phonons is probably somewhere close to this line. Now, if you take electron-electron interactions, look at the expression for the bare value in terms of the actual Coulomb interactions. These are some electrostatic energies of actual Coulomb interactions with respect to some densities constructed on the actual block wave functions for the k and k prime values. So that energy has to be positive. We know that from no Lipschitz or other things. So the bare value of anisotropies due to electron interactions is somewhere here. And if you say that this overlap of orbitals sitting on different sublattices is quite negligible, so then the point is closer to this line. Then you have, so in principle, you have to sum these two vectors and you end up somewhere here. If we take into account the renormalizations due to Coulomb interactions of the short-range couplings for electron-electron interactions, then if you start with such initial conditions, kind of systematically it wants to drive the system to this space. So negative U perpendicular gets generated. So it would be most realistic for graphene to be in this quadrant. And if you want my biased opinion, I think it's the antiferromagnetic phase.
The renormalization will depend on whether the sample is on a substrate or not.
To some extent, yes, you will have some dielectric screen for your bare Coulomb interactions.
I guess, yes.
So, yeah, but that kind of reinforces this point. In principle, you can have also some disorder, some issues of the dielectric environment. Disorder can also renormalize these couplings. This was also done by Igor. So, therefore, even in real system, you can have some other factors which would give you some more uncertainty.
Is there anything that you're in different places in suspended and supported?
Then it's just a question of varying the dielectric constant, essentially.
But I mean experimentally, that may suggest that the ground state is different depending on the substrate.
If the interaction properties change to such extent that you end up in a different phase? Yes. From experimental data, at this point, I would say we don't have sufficient data. So mostly what was seen is that this two-terminal conductance of the new equal zero state is insulated. So that's the key experimental fact. But that can correspond to three phases, at least, for, without disorder.
Did you say currently the experimental data are not sufficient to
On monolayer, kind of on a sensor, I'd say no, but for bilayer, I say that the only phase consistent with the experimental data is the cantile interferomagnetic phase. In bilayer, they have these dual gated devices, so they can polarize this layer isospin. And they see transitions from the insulating state at lower electric field to insulating state at higher electric fields. Those phases are most probably the layer polarized phases. But so the presence of this phase transition, so they're characterized by conductance spikes in the two terminal conductance. So the presence of these transitions is consistent with only one phase. If you add this Verli isospin effect and replot it in the space of the electric energy and Zeeman energy.
Because the experiments about the activation energy in the insulating phase, about the behavior of the magnetic
field? There were, yes, for monolayer, for new equal zero state, the activation energy decreases, or rather the resistance decreases, let me put it this way. For bilayer, there is a recent, yet unpublished, experiment by Philip Kim's group on dual-gated bilayers on boron nitrate substrate, where they see a dramatic drop in resistance. They have a hole bar, and it's RxX resistance, as the essentially parallel component of the field is applied, while perpendicular one is kept fixed. So my idea is that this is consistent with the cantile interferomagnetic phase for the following reason. So you have to look at the edge excitations. And the spin polarized phase, this ferromagnetic phase, is predicted to have gapless counterpropagating edge excitations. There is a unresolved issues of how robust those states should be, but for ideal system, you have gapless counterpropagating edge states. Antiferromagnetic phase has gapped edge excitation. So if I plot some infield cartoon picture, this is for antiferromagnetic phase, this is for spin polarized phase. Now, cantile interferomagnetic phase continuously interpolates between the two phases, and you go from antiferromagnetic to spin polarized phase by tilting the field. So just by continuity argument, the edge transport gap of the cantile interferomagnetic phase should decrease and close once the spin polarized phase is reached. So as you apply the parallel component, it will go from gap phase excitations to gapless. And so I believe this is what is seen in this recent experiment.
But if you want to experimentally distinguish antiferromagnet and Kepler distortion, what would be the experiment? Something like an
For Kepler distortion, if you want transport, then if you also do the tilted field experiment, neither the bulk nor edge transport gap should change much or if at all.
And would you make, I mean, if you make something like X-ray diffraction?
Well, if you want to probe the actual physical order, one can think of Sure, many different probes, but the problem is we have one atomic monolayer. Normally for such experiments, or you could try to do neutron scattering to probe the antiferromagnetic phase, you need a bulk sample.
Neutron is probably an molecule, but I think that's reasonable.
with the Kekulé phase,
is it an STM?
STM should be should quite easily distinguish charge density wave from anything charge balanced.
Because you have different lattice periods, right?
Yes, but this order is very elusive. So essentially, you want to probe some coherence between the sublattices. For me, it's hard to think.
Probably hopeless, but I mean, seeing two different periods should be feasible.
But in what physical quantity? If you're probing net charge, so that wouldn't show much.
No, I mean, if you probe net charge, you will not see anything. I mean, it should be, of course, some scattering, which would be sensitive to this period. Like you should be. The K period is in 2K or something.
It's
commensurate with
something.
Charge would look the same. So.
I don't know. So this Kekulé phase seems to me the most elusive for an experimental probe.
Continue to discuss a little bit the questions of strong correlations and the strong magnetic field. Thank you for the nice introduction.
Huh? Oh, is it
cool? Sure.
So, is there some decent chalk left?
There's
some very tiny ones. And I will, it's your job. I will get a little bit back to the question of the SU4 symmetric interaction part. So as Maxim has already said, we have different energy scales that I just want to rediscuss a little bit. So this was on the order of 650 times the square root of B in Tesla times Kelvin divided by the dielectric constant, whatever it is. So this depends on the substrate. This depends also on screening effects via inter-band excitations. And so what has been discussed just recently was, previously was that there are symmetry breaking terms that are suppressed because of the lattice scale, and this gives rise to something that is on the order of 1, I would say rather 1 than 10 times B in Tesla Kelvin, and again divided by the dielectric constant. And this brings us also to the energy scale of other symmetry breaking terms, such as the Zeeman effect that was on the order of 1 Kelvin times B in Tesla. Okay, so these are indeed symmetry breaking terms that afterwards, for example, orient a preformed ferromagnet, quantum Hall ferromagnet. And I want to get back a little bit to this energy scale and forget about the fact that at the end of the day, this quantum Hall ferromagnetism is indeed oriented in some way, because I mean my job is to go to the fractional quantum Hall effect, but I want to make an addendum to what has been said, because actually the first time that I came here was 5 years ago. There was a graphene workshop, and we had at that time discussions between people coming from two different communities. One coming from the quantum Hall effect, and for those people, everything was clear. Everything was the quantum Hall ferromagnet. In what sense soever, as has been pointed out, there is the spinning quantum Hall ferromagnet. There can be a valley isospin quantum Hall ferromagnet. And then there were people coming rather from high energy or quantum field theoretical descriptions who talked about magnetic catalysis. So, and actually at that time, we didn't really understand what the connection between these two phenomena was. And I just want to point out what I think now our present understanding of that is. So I want to talk about quantum Hall ferromagnetism briefly versus magnetic catalysis. And in order to do so, I just need to consider this energy scale. So first of all, what do people think when they talk about magnetic catalysis? Magnetic catalysis is something like you form an exciton, and these excitons condense. And the reason for this is, consider, for example, graphene, first of all, in the absence of a magnetic field. So then we can have an exciton formation, or could have, by exciting a hole or an electron from the valence band to the conduction band, and now we could think of lowering the energy of the state because of the interaction, the attractive interaction between the electron and the hole. So the idea was something like this. Okay, we could open a gap just by condensing these electron hole pairs, so these excitons, and this would open up something like a mass gap, and because it would break the sublattice symmetry. So in the absence of a magnetic field, this does not take place, and this could be, for example, understood in the framework of a weak coupling analysis. And the reason for this is that the density of states, so the mechanism is suppressed because of the vanishing density of states. As you know, the density of states in graphene is linear in the electric field, in the energy. And so once you go to the Dirac point, this goes to zero, and this suppresses any type of instability, at least from a weak coupling point of view. So the idea was that this could be enhanced, for example, by applying a magnetic field, because in a magnetic field, this density of states becomes quenched into lambda levels, and these lambda levels are given, or the density of states is given by an internal degree degeneracy, which is spin valley, times the flux density, and then I have here the sum over all lambda levels, epsilon minus epsilon n, and these are just the lambda levels. So I find now a delta peak-like density of states exactly at zero energy, and this so at zero energy, I would find in graphene a density of states that scales linearly with the magnetic field, and the idea was we could perhaps in this case now trigger this instability towards a type of exciton condensation. And this is indeed what people have in mind when they talk about magnetic catalysis. So now I come back a little bit.
This exciton condensation is just the antiferromagnet.
Not necessarily. It is not necessarily located on the.
It's the question of the structure of the gap in the area.
It is. I will come to that in a second, because I think the easiest way to discuss it is indeed in terms of these M8 spinners. Yeah, we can. I come to that in a second. Okay. Because the spin does not necessarily play a role in this. This exit condensation.
So it might not be necessarily the spin anti-ferromagnet. It could be also some kind of charge density wave.
Yes, exactly.
So it's supersymmetry from the very beginning. If you start with the Dirac system, it's SU4.
Yeah.
Therefore, it could be anything.
It could be, yeah, exactly. So, but let me discuss it indeed, this mass gap opening. So in terms of order parameters, and then I think we can see quite easily the structure of it. So this mass term is in magnetic catalysis is actually proportional to an order parameter that has this form. So I use the same notation as Maxime, that's your name, right? Before, so it is given in terms of a Pauli matrix. It couples to the AB sublattice spin. This is the part that you've put away because it doesn't play a role, especially in higher lambda levels. This is fixed, and then the lowest lambda level, we also see that it is actually fixed. So and then it is proportional to the one matrix and the valley index and the spin index. Okay. So now psi is an eight spinner. And these are just the combinations. So the order parameters that were discussed before, so this is magnetic catalysis, or the order parameter of a dynamical mass gap generation. And quantum Hall ferromagnetism is just given by, for example, if we consider a spin ferromagnet, this would just be given by psi dagger. Then I have here the one matrix, again, the one matrix in the valley case. And here I would have a Pauli matrix in spin, degree of freedom, the valley ferromagnet would be the same, roughly just when I replace the role of the spin and the valley. So this would be tau nu valley times one psi, the spin. And these are, so to say, just the spin and valley, the pure states. But since we have an SU4 symmetry, we can go to higher. We have other generators or other order parameters that are given by this thing here. So this would be, so to say, entangled spin valley order parameters. And for example, the antiferromagnetic state that was discussed is exactly in this case. It is would be proportional, for example, to something like tau z valley times tau z spin. This would be here the antiferromagnetic state. So it is not a contradiction to talk about, on the one hand side, of an antiferromagnetic state, and to see that this is part, actually, of the SE4 quantum Hall ferromagnetic phase. So now, in principle, these order parameters are different from a symmetry point of view, as you may see here. So the mass gap, at first sight, does not have anything to do with this type of order parameters of quantum Hall ferromagnetism. But the first thing that you need to take into account is actually this mass gap generation cannot lift the lambda level degeneracy in higher lambda levels, so different from n equal to 0. It is capable only of lifting the degeneracy in the n equal to 0 lambda level. When I take a look at the lambda level spectrum, indeed, it looks like this. So n equal to 0 is lifted. And the other ones are just shifted in energy by this this term that comes in this order parameter. However, in n equal to 0, we have this chiral symmetry, which means that, for example, the A sublattice component at the K point vanishes as well as the K prime component on the B sublattice. So these particles in a particular valley live on a well-defined sublattice space. And in this case, you see that out of these many components here, 8 components, actually half of them just die away or go away. And indeed, one can show when just going through the algebra, writing down these order parameters component by component, that actually the mass term here, this order parameter, is exactly proportional, identical with the valley order parameter. So a valley polarization in the z direction. Okay.
Excuse me. If they are forced to live in one of the sublattices, do there is an effect on the spin polarization or not?
No, not here, because this is independent of the spin. Okay. It's just this coupling between valley and sublattice. Okay. So in this case, one simply in n equal to 0 cannot distinguish between a dynamical mass gap generation and just quantum Hall ferromagnetism in the valley channel. Okay. So magnetic catalysis can be understood in the framework of quantum Hall ferromagnetism, but it cannot, magnetic catalysis cannot lift the Landau level degeneracy in higher Landau levels. So, but this is why I would say nowadays that quantum Hall ferromagnetism should be considered as the leading mechanism of Landau level degeneracy lifting, because from an experimental point of view, this was worked by the Kim group. Dean et al. In Nature Physics, 2011. They have seen the Landau level degeneracy lifting both in n equal to 0, where they find plus minus 1 states in the 0 state, as well as in n equal to 1, where they find plus minus, 3. Plus minus 4, and plus minus 5. Okay? So, and the other reason why I think it is more correct to talk about quantum Hall ferromagnetism is because of the internal symmetry, actually, we find that these different ground states, which belong to the same ground state manifold, are coupled by Goldstone modes. And these Goldstone modes have indeed a Q-square dependence, as you would expect for spin waves. And they don't have, at least here, a Q-linear and Q-dependence, as you would expect for excitonic condensation. I think the only difference or the only exception would be in the ferromagnetic phase you were talking about. But this needs to be checked. OK.
Unless you include anisotropies, they should all be Q-square.
Once you include anisotropies, I mean, I'm only on the level of the SU4. Because you can also connect them via a spin wave. Indeed, you find degenerate Goldstone modes, which all scale as or all behave as Q-square. Naturally, anisotropies afterwards, they can favor one channel or the other one, and give gaps, for example, to some of the Goldstone modes, eventually to any of them. Okay. So, by the way, the same argument of components that go to zero also show, for example, something I think quite nice for those that this makes a connection with the quantum spin Hall effect or topological insulators. That is, you've seen indeed, for example, for a for a spin dominated quantum Hall ferromagnetism in the lowest Lander level, for example, when we have a large Zeeman effect, then we would polarize in this way, k prime, and once we get to the edge, we see degeneracy lifting in the valley subspace, and we find counterpropagating states. And this is also a generic picture, for example, for the quantum spin Hall effect, where you have counterpropagating helical edge streams. So that means that the particular direction is not of propagation is coupled to the spin orientation of at the edge. And indeed, in the same way as here, for example, the mass term is identical to the Z polarization of the quantum spin Hall effect in the valley channel. Here one can say, for example, that the spin orbit coupling, which is usually triggering this quantum spin Hall effect, is exactly identical in n equal to zero to the Zeeman effect in this sense. By the same token, that means that these components are simply zero. Okay, so now I come to the fractional quantum Hall effect to point out perhaps some things, because I mean also he,
for quantum Hall effect, is this picture really protected?
It depends.
So I think it depends means it's not protected.
It is not protected as soon as you have interactions to take into account. Okay. So interactions here, for example, by the same token, if you have, for example, interactions that give rise to Goldstone modes, and if they are, for example, possible in the subspace, so for example, you have an external field that permits a certain number of Goldstone modes, and if in this case you can rotate continuously your ferromagnetic state in the spin channel to something in the valley channel, well, you know that you don't have have edge states here, then it is not protected. Okay, the whole periodic table of topological insulators is only valid in the absence of interactions, and this is clear, for example, here.
Symmetric interactions, as the one with symmetry breakage. So then it was a problem studied by Fertig and Gray, who showed that so then this quantum covariance should be
then
a strongly interacting system, then the edge excitations are still gapless, but they are collective. For some particular model of edge,
yes, that's true. It was shown for specific
Right. The question about when you face with any counterpropagating mode is there any rule which explicitly forbids you backscattering in any order perturbation theory in any mechanism allowed by symmetry? For the quantum spin Hall effect, such symmetry exists. You can write topological invariant which protects you. Here, can you do it?
It's an open question.
It's an open question, I would say.
But it's another symmetric one, so why should it exist? I mean, it may only exist in some approximation if you need lasers. You have magnetic field, it's a broken time reversal. It's a wrong symmetric one. So how can it exist?
I think you would need to
be small, that's fine. Yeah, but there is
No, but you could, for example, consider all types of Z2 symmetries and reconsider them here, perhaps effective time reversal symmetry operators that would work.
But at the moment, you had generating theories and take into account that there was a time reversal broken,
will break down. I fully agree with you. This the same thing, for example, as in the quantum spin Hall effect.
No,
As long as you protect time reversal symmetry, impurity cannot backscatter.
Okay, I think of a magnetic impurity. When you put it in magnetic impurity,
exactly,
but it's
that's exactly what I'm saying.
It breaks time reversal.
But here it's already broken.
We don't have time reversal symmetry here. So now I think we need to consider a certain class of impurities, and perhaps there is something like a hidden symmetry, but this is something which is speculated.
The way it looks like is a qualitative level. So if you take an edge of a topological insulator and not a Zeeman term, which has only the component along this spin quantization axis, that term, it does break time reversal symmetry, but it does not open again.
It shifts. It has some additional symmetry which is artificial.
Yes. So it's the kind of qualitative argument
that
supports it.
Okay. Then let me go towards the fractional quantum Hall effect. Before starting really with the fractional quantum Hall effect, it's a very particular topic, and I will need to make some short reminders of what the fractional quantum Hall effect is, and just let me start with some history. In graphene, as compared to gallium arsenide. So in 2005, we had the discovery of the integer quantum Hall effect by the Manchester and the Columbia group. So very soon afterwards, there were first theoretical studies by different groups, among which our own, on the fractional quantum Hall effect in graphene. And it became clear quite soon that the most important thing or characteristic of the fractional quantum Hall effect in graphene is indeed that we need to go from SU2 to SU4. So the internal degrees of freedom are the relevant difference with respect to gallium arsenide. And for comparison, I just give you also the dates of the discovery in gallium arsenide. So this was in 1980 by Klaus von Klitzing. So in gallium arsenide. And it took us even longer in graphene to have first indications of a fractional quantum Hall effect in graphene. Took us 4 years, roughly. But the first experiments actually were in the two-terminal geometry. And it was a year later that there were experiments by the Kim group. So these first experiments were by the Kim group and Eva Andreas group. And here it was a fractional quantum Hall effect in the four-terminal geometry, which is better defined. And this was both unsuspended graphene and graphene on boronitride substrates. Okay? Let me just say briefly what. For comparison, the time difference between the observation of the integer and the fraction quantum Hall effect here was just 2 years. So there it was 1982 gallium arsenide. So it was a little bit harder to get from the integer quantum Hall effect to the fraction quantum Hall effect in graphene than in gallium. It was not in gallium arsenide. This was in MOSFET heterostructures, semiconductor structures. Okay.
Can I make this suggestion? It's already 12.
Yeah.
We didn't plug 43-hour session today. So we probably have to extend the discussion on the four factual discussions. And also, when Indiana points it out, we can introduce words fractional. Finish with the historical overview and stop it, and then the content actually will be delivered in a more
we can do that
condensed way with a little bit more information coming up in a separate meeting. Maybe we have to discuss one. Maybe today, later in the afternoon, or tomorrow, or something like that.
Today is 3.
3? Okay.
Maybe this is fine.
How about that? How about today is 3 o'clock? We can see.
Well, we probably need to check the room a little bit.
Not me.
We just need to look at the
suggestion. It was just too shy to waste it up breaking into this interesting historical.
I'd say 2 or 3, 2.3. I don't know.
Depending on the room a little bit.
And 3 is probably fine, but the problem is
Just go there and look whether it is.
No, we'll do it differently. You finish historical introduction and I'll.
Actually, the good break would perhaps be that I just before going into the theory, in order to finish this history of graphene, I wanted to point out the main experimental findings of the Kim group, namely on graphene on boron nitride. And I think that will take me 5 minutes or roughly, perhaps a little bit more. And this would be a break before going into the more theoretical discussion of the fraction quantum Hall effect. And then we can continue in the afternoon or whenever the room is free. So the main finding of the Kim group was indeed that in n equal to 0, so in n equal to, it was the discovery of what I would call the 1/3 family. Okay? So in n equal to 0, what we have is essentially, consider for example that we have for the moment, a very strong spin valley degeneracy lifting by external fields. So a huge Zeeman effect. In this case, our n equal to 0 lambda level would split into four branches. So this would be the first situation of a complete SU4 symmetry breaking. By, and then I say, and physically, large Zeeman type fields. So in this case, one would have the complete lifting of the fourfold degeneracy of the n equal to zero lambda level, and even in the absence of interaction. So it's not as spontaneously generated as your force symmetry breaking, as for example by the mechanism of quantum Hall ferromagnetism, but by external fields. So what we have here is the opposite limit, where these fields, which we have identified as very small, would be very large. Okay? I split all of them, just for illustration reasons. Okay? So in this case, what we would have is we would have here the 1/3 quantum Hall effect. Okay? One would have indeed an n equal to zero, a 1/3 quantum Hall effect that is related by particle Hall symmetry, which needs to be defined now with respect to a single branch to 2/3. Okay. So one would expect these states, okay, both for plus and minus, because we have the same thing here, would be related to minus 2/3. And actually, each of the lambda levels would be, the sub-branches would be the same, because the orbital wave function in each of the sub-levels would be the same. The orbital wave functions do not change when they go from this sub-branch to this one, because they are only governed by the lambda level quantum number. Okay. And I would have here minus 4/3, which would be related by to minus 5/3. So one would expect, actually, these states here, minus 4/3 plus minus 5/3. Okay? And experimentally, this state was missing. Or either it was not seen, or it was too weak to be seen. So either it is really absent, or it was too weak to be seen. So in this case, what one can already see is that this complete SU4 symmetry breaking in terms of external fields is indeed unphysical, just with respect to experiments. Naturally, this is also expected just from the energy scales. But let's consider this, because people often talk about, indeed, of completely polarized states, or a complete lifting of the spin valley degeneracy, and then do simply Laughlin physics, so one component physics.
All right.
Can
we stop at this point?
I just finished the introduction, and just to consider now the second case. If we had a partial lifting. So for example, consider just a Zeeman effect, spin Zeeman effect. Or the valley Zeeman effect. Okay? In this case, I would have a large gap here, but roughly a degeneracy here. This would be, so to say, in SU2 situation, where each of these two sub-branches now would be described by an internal SU2 degree of freedom, okay? Which could be, for example, the valley if this is a spin Zeeman effect. So this would be a residual SU2 symmetry. In this case, particle Hall symmetry would need to be defined with respect to this level, in which case we would have a correspondence between nu and 2 minus nu. And here on the other side, we would have minus nu, which would be related to minus 2 plus nu. Again, in this case, one would expect to see, for example, if we see the 1/3 state, one would also expect to see the 5/3 state. Okay, so again, the situation is in contradiction to experiment. And indeed, the only situation that is really can really account for the experimental findings is that we need to take into account the internal SU4 degree of freedom for the sublattices, because in this case, the only symmetry that we have is particle hole symmetry, in which case we would need to to relate minus 2 plus mu to 2 minus mu. Okay? And in this case, the 5/3 state would only be related to the minus 5/3 state, which is then in agreement with the experimental findings.
Why do you exclude the possibility that there is no particle hole symmetry at all, which is indeed the case in the physical system?
You mean when you take into account?
Just one SU2 symmetric level. I mean, due to the coupling to the rest of the levels, your particle hole symmetry is artificial.
You mean once you go a little bit away from nu equal to zero?
In the pair of W's that you showed. Your argument was that there is an intrinsic.
Okay, so what you would say, for example, is you break the particle hole symmetry. Once you take into account other or additional lambda levels,
yes.
In this case, you would have. I think you will still have an effect. I think you will still have a particle hole symmetry, or at least a symmetry in which you relate, in this case, mu to minus mu. Because what you're thinking of is what happens if I admix higher lambda levels, for example. I could do that, indeed, if I'm for example, in the particle channel, okay, then indeed the admixture of empty lambda levels in the conduction band is different from the mixture of completely filled lambda levels from the valence band. But if I go to the opposite limit, then I need to sweep also the admixture from empty states, which are now again, which intervene not only empty states in the conduction band, but also inside the n equal to zero lambda level. I think you still have the symmetry then.
No, I don't think so. You don't have any symmetry. But by analogy to gallium arsenide, if you look at the new one.
Yeah, but in gallium arsenide, what you have is, for example, what you're thinking of is n equal to 1, okay? And 5/2. This is the question,
yes,
about the Pfaffian and the anti-Pfaffian.
Oh, for example, yes.
Yeah. In this case, you can indeed say, okay, I have this situation, so I'm a little. I'm in this situation that I have a completely filled lambda level here, okay, and a completely empty lambda level here. Here, you're right. The situation that, so to say, say 2 minus mu is related to mu is no longer possible.
Yes.
This is true. But here I'm talking about states in the conduction band. So this is not defined. This is the total filling factor. This is not the filling factor.
I understand. I'm just looking at your diagram with two doublets. And as far as I can see, there is no obvious particle hole symmetry.
You mean here, in this case, for example?
So which symmetry are we discussing?
Yeah.
Mu to 2 minus mu or mu to minus mu? So mu to 2 minus mu is always
okay.
True symmetry.
Now I understand this point. He thinks of this symmetry here, for example.
This one, like 1/3 and 2/3, that's always an only approximate. Yeah, there is no answer
for the
symmetry.
Okay, I agree with you. This is
approximate in gallium arsenide, and it's not exact there. It's only approximate there, and it's also approximate here.
Yes. So it is approximate also here in the sense, yeah. It becomes a good symmetry when I eject all the lambda levels to very high energies.
So,
yeah,
so
then I would
agree. The particle hole symmetry arguments, that's not exactly work. You cannot also exclude the possibility that.
I agree with you. If you go beyond the the approximation of a single lambda level, then you will probably need to take other lambda levels into account. And this, but this is given again also by the dielectric constant. So I mean, as much as the dielectric constant, for example, blows up, I think the approximation becomes.
I couldn't agree more. Yes, for an infinite dielectric constant.
Well, for an infinite, it's perhaps not what you want. But I mean, this is boron nitride. So the dielectric constant in boron nitride is pretty large. So, and then there's the question of also of completely.
Can you say again, what is observed in experiment?
In experiment, in experiments, all these fractional quantum Hall states on boron nitride were observed, apart from the 5/3 state.
So the symmetry nu to minus nu is okay, yeah?
The symmetry nu to minus nu is okay, fortunately. But I can answer also your question in a different way. When I go to nu equal to 1, to n equal to 1, to the higher lambda level, then all members of the 1/3 states have been observed. So there, for example, you can play the same trick in n equal to 1, okay? And then n equal to 1, you have seen the, what is it now, the 7/3 state, the 8/3 state, the 10/3 state, and the 11/3 state. So all four of them, plus minus, have been observed. And I would expect in n equal to 1, the particle, this internal, so to say, particle Hall symmetry per subbranch or per lambda level to be less prominent than in n equal to 0 because of the relative proximity of other lambda levels. But there, everything has been seen. So there you could argue perhaps in terms of other symmetry breaking terms. But in principle, you're right.
Yeah, I'm sorry, when you're talking about observation, how wide your plateau, how well is it defined?
I cannot say how wide it is, but it's visible by the eye.
Well, yeah, so, if you have a Lagging eye and if you know what to look for, yes, then you can interpret the feature. But when I looked at this graph and when I didn't have a ruler,
yeah, but I mean, even by the eye, I agree with you. By the eye, it was evident that the 5/3 state was absent.
Yeah,
so at least it is too weak to be seen. And then afterwards, I mean, also for example, activation gap experiments were done, and it seems that there was roughly the same energy scale for the different 1/3 members inside each level, so which would hint to the same activation behavior at least. It doesn't mean that the low energy physics is necessarily the same, but we come back to that afterwards.
Change from suspended to boron nitride.
Yes, because of the dielectric constant.
Okay.